You've reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your message after the tone.
Hi, ELT. This is Sarah. I really just want to know about all of the ghosts of birth control past. What happened to the diaphragm? Why are we no longer deciding if a guy is sponge-worthy or not? Thanks.
Hello?
Hey, Sarah. It's Flora from ELT.
Hello.
Tell me a little bit about you. Where am I finding you? What do you do?
I am a librarian in Kelowna, British Columbia.
So what got you thinking about the ghosts of birth control past?
Yeah, I guess I started to think about this a few years back when I was wanting to switch birth control. And I just remembered all of these other options that seemed to exist before. And I wondered where they went.
Such as?
Well, the big one was the diaphragm. And my context for that was the story that my mom told me when I was younger. My mom is kind of what you would describe as an old hippie. She only wears flip-flops. She's always in tie-dye. She's got this amazing curly hair that's always a mess. And she told me about a time in the 70s, maybe the early 80s. She was living in Vancouver here in Canada, and she was part of this women's group. And I guess it was just this empowerment thing of let's take control of our bodies. And they gathered around together and squatted over some mirrors, and they all fitted themselves for diaphragms.
Wow, what a scene.
Yeah, it's burned into my mind. I learned that story very young.
How young?
Oh, gosh. 12, maybe.
Your mom sounds great.
She's a character.
Are you kindred spirits? Are you wearing tie-dye and flip-flops right now?
I would say I'm a little more buttoned up than my mom. Not surprising, being that I'm a librarian.
So, Sarah, you wanted to know what happened to the diaphragm.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go back even further. I want to tell you how birth control got into your mom's living womb in the first place.
All right.
Because that afternoon in the 70s, with your mom and her friends squatting over mirrors to do diaphragm self-exams, that would have been unthinkable in Canada just 40 years earlier. That's what I want to tell you about today. And we double-bagged just the expert to fill us in.
Hi, Sarah. Great question.
That's Elizabeth Kester.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth is a lawyer-turned-historian, and she wrote a book about one of the most famous trials in birth control history. The crime was sharing birth control information. The trial took place in Ontario in 1936, in the middle of the Depression.
This trial was just a cause celebre. You can imagine, in the middle of the Depression, a trial about birth control, well, that was like better than any television series that we wait for today.
The trial lasted 6 months, one of the longest in Canadian history. 40 witnesses testified, 23 boxes of contraceptives were presented as evidence. And the defendant in this trial was this young woman, Dorothea Palmer. She was a 28-year-old social worker.
Dorothea Palmer, I guess in those days, might have been called a real pistol. She is confident. She is feisty. She has strong views.
Strong views about contraception and getting people access to it.
She thought women had the right to birth control and to plan their own family. And she was going to distribute birth control information.
So Palmer made this her mission. She met with women in their homes to tell them about contraception. And at the time, this was risky work. In the 1930s in Canada,
it was prohibited under the Criminal Code of Canada, under the obscenity section, to distribute birth control, to advertise birth control, and to sell birth control.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, so birth control was technically legal. You were allowed to use it, but the law made it hard to get, unless you had resources.
If you were educated, if you were middle class or upper middle class, you could figure it out, or you could find a doctor who might help you.
Some pharmacies sold it on the sly, but for people without money or means, contraception was hard to come by.
Right.
And that's who Dorothea Palmer was helping.
That makes sense. That's fantastic.
So this was Palmer's passion, but it was also her job, and she wasn't working alone. She was employed by a wealthy businessman named A.R. Kaufman.
His full name was Alvin Ratz Kaufman.
And Kaufman owned a rubber factory.
Interesting.
Yeah, but not those rubbers.
Okay.
He made fishing gear and boots, the condoms of the feet.
Of course.
He made Sorel boots, which is, you know, something that anybody in Canada, we've all had a pair of Sorel boots at some point in our lives.
I have walked around in many a Canadian winter in Sorel boots. I guess I'm curious how the boot guy got into this. Where's his passion lie?
Why is a bootmaker hiring Palmer to distribute contraceptives?
Yeah.
So Kaufman got interested in birth control by way of one of his side projects. And it's not good.
He was a founder of the Eugenics Society of Canada. And his initial drive was for eugenic reasons.
Oh. Should have known it all comes back to eugenics.
Is that a phrase in Canada?
You know, it's not, but we do have a storied history there.
You're not alone. You know, I think many of us associate eugenics with the Nazis, but it goes back a lot farther than that and was much more widespread. The word eugenics was coined in the 1880s, partly inspired by Charles Darwin's ideas about survival of the fittest. The idea is to produce a, quote, better human race by regulating reproduction.
And the race could mean anything from kind of what we think of as race related to skin color or nationality or religion or ethnicity. And in that sense, eugenics was a real shapeshifter. It could be whatever anyone needed it to be.
Yeah, this is troubling.
And even more troubling, eugenic ideas were widely accepted in the 1930s.
It was unbelievably mainstream. These ideas literally swept the world. And they were front page news. People gave talks about eugenics. You could go and see movies that promoted eugenic ideas. At state fairs in the US and in Canada, there were eugenic displays. They had fit family contests.
What is that? What's a fit family contest?
Oh, a fit family contest is people would compete to get the prize at the local fair for the best baby or the fit family. And the pictures of them are, you know, you see a nice blonde family with seven children and mother and father, and they're all wearing their 1930s bathing suits. So this idea of like fitness and eugenics and promoting better families was just, it was everywhere.
Well, I have a photo up in my house of my grandmother in a baby beauty pageant, and I'm having all kinds of different feelings about that now.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been right around that time. Yeah, I have learned about eugenics in Canadian history, but I had no idea how widespread it was and how interlaced it was with just culture in general. This goes even beyond what I realize.
I know. And we're not just talking about farm fairs or movies. Eugenics, of course, was put into practice in really horrifying ways in the early 1900s and beyond.
Eugenics in the U.S. ultimately resulted in 60,000 people being legally sterilized. And I'm sure there were others outside the law. But 30 American states passed eugenic sterilization laws. Two Canadian provinces did, and several other provinces attempted to pass sterilization laws.
These laws made it legal for people in power to forcibly sterilize people they deemed, quote, unfit. And marginalized groups were often the targets of this violence. Indigenous populations, people of color, poor people, people with physical or intellectual disabilities. Even the highest U.S. court sanctioned this. In 1927, the Supreme Court ruled that forced sterilization was legal in the case of a, quote, feeble-minded woman.
Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, the revered Supreme Court judge, said three generations of imbeciles are enough.
Ugh.
And it wasn't just forced sterilization. Regular old birth control, like diaphragms and condoms were also vital to eugenics by keeping certain people from having kids.
I never made that connection, but I can see it now.
So A.R. Kaufman, the rubber factory owner, believed the human race should have fewer of some kinds of people and more of other kinds.
He was anti-French, anti-Catholic, anti-poor people.
Which is exactly the people who worked in his rubber factory.
Oh, gosh.
He thought those people were having too many kids, and he had some ideas about how to solve that quote-unquote problem. Ideas like sterilizing his own workers at the factory.
He offered the male workers having vasectomies, and there's some historical controversy about whether he required that or just offered it.
Wow.
It was happening in the sick room of the factory.
That's so dark. That's horrifying. I guess I have a bit of surprise that it's the men whose bodies are being regulated in this situation.
He made sure women were offered sterilization as well. It just happened in the hospital, not at the factory. And that was just the beginning. Kaufman decides he can do more. He has a plan B. He expands his operation past the factory doors and creates an organization for distributing birth control information. It's called the Parents Information Bureau. And he's targeting people he thinks should not be having children. And this isn't a dinky mom and pop shop operation.
He's reaching tens of thousands of people. And he has about 50 employees across the country.
And one of the employees he brought on to help spill the jelly on contraceptives was Dorothea Palmer.
Gosh, is she part of this horrible eugenics nightmare as well?
Elizabeth says no.
She gave interviews at the time. She gave interviews later in her life. And there's nothing that she ever said that made me think she was doing this for the same kind of motives that Kaufman had. I only found her very strong views about birth control.
So I guess just using the tools available to do what she could for people.
Yes. I think Kaufman was using her to advance his interests. And I think that she was using him to advance her. So sort of a mutual using relationship.
So Dorothea went to women's homes and told them that she could hook them up with contraceptives, which was a criminal act, remember?
Right.
And she said at one point, and if you throw me in jail, I'll go as soon as I'm out, I will go right back.
And in jail, she was thrown. In 1936, Dorothea Palmer was arrested for violating the obscenity law. And her boss, Kaufman, he was actually pumped.
That she was thrown in jail?
Yes, he wanted it to go to trial.
Why?
Because he saw her arrest as an opportunity to test the law. There was a legal loophole which said that you could talk about obscene things if it was in the public good.
And I think the idea was that the public good defense had never been used in connection with birth control. And he and his lawyer believed that it would be successful.
Kaufman knew that if Palmer was found to be acting in the public good, then he could continue this eugenics project without worrying about his birth control staff getting arrested.
Yeah, that makes sense. Sucks for our birth control hero.
She seemed to be on board.
Palmer wanted to go to trial. I think she thought that this needed to be settled for women.
Wow, she's committed.
After the break, the trial of the Canadian century.
I think to myself, like, would I have been brave enough to stand up in a court and say something that my husband and my priest didn't want me to say?
So Kaufman hired a fancy lawyer to prove that Dorothea Palmer was acting in the public good. And he spared no expense. He shelled out $500,000 Canadian dollars in today's Canadian money to pay for her defense. And this trial was an event.
Yes, it was a huge sensation. There were people lined up every day to get in, and it was small so that not everybody could. And there were newspapers, stringers running in and running out, getting stories to their editor.
And Palmer's defense leaned on eugenics in their arguments.
The defense had, I think, 13 arguments about the public good, and eugenics formed a couple of them.
So the prosecution called 21 women Palmer had visited, and they confirmed that Palmer did what she'd been charged with. She gave them information about birth control. But then the defense got to cross-examine them.
The defense's lawyer asked every one of those women, did you want birth control information? And with one exception, they all answered yes. I thought I needed that information. I was going to use it. I had abortions I would not have had if I had known how to prevent pregnancies in the first place. And really, if you just imagine those women, they were poor, they were uneducated, they were speaking through a translator, but they were in an English language court. They were going against what their priests said, what their husbands said, and they were saying, I want birth control information. And I just find that incredibly moving. I think to myself, like, would I have been brave enough to stand up in a court? And, you know, and I'm a lawyer. I kind of know that environment and say something that my husband and my priest didn't want me to say. And they did it one after another. There were 20 of those women said that. And the voices of those women come through today so powerfully.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. Just with what I know about that era, just like Elizabeth said, how brave that is to speak out against all these men, their husbands, the priests, and say, this is what we want and this is what we need. That's incredible.
Yeah. So the judge ruled in Palmer's favor. He found that she was acting in the public good.
Wow. Okay.
But what he saw as the public good might not be what you're thinking.
The ruling relied a lot on the eugenic arguments. One of the things that the judge talked about, which is a very eugenic concept, was this idea that the mentally unfit especially were more fertile than the upper middle class white people. So it's in the public good to give these people birth control information.
He didn't want those women having too many babies because they weren't the kind of Canadians they were hoping for.
What I'm not hearing a lot in the judge's ruling are like women's rights or a public good.
No.
Yeah, I guess that's a sign of the times.
A sign of those times, a sign of these times, a sign of many of the times in between. It's enduring.
Yeah. Yeah.
So women's rights weren't why the judge found that it was a public good, but that ruling that you could talk about contraception really was good for people.
This was a huge step for women, for men, for families in Canada. It was a very important public health step.
No one was ever charged again for disseminating birth control information in Canada. The ruling opened the door for birth control information to flow without a barrier. But unfortunately, it was eugenics and eugenicists that lubricated the way.
Yeah.
I think we have to recognize that birth control and eugenics traveled hand in hand.
And the thing is, it wasn't just Kaufman. Many birth control pioneers in the U.S. and the U.K. were also eugenicists.
This is really hard because so much good for women came out of it, but in such an awful way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Which obviously really sucks. It sucks that people wouldn't have control over their own bodies without eugenicists. It's also unimaginably sad that eugenicists violently took away people's control over their bodies through legal forced sterilization that went on in the US and Canada into the 70s. And these eugenic ghosts still haunt us today.
Promoted in an opinion written by Justice Clarence Thomas, which sought to link Planned Parenthood, contraception, and abortion to the racist views of the eugenics movement in the early 20th century.
Modern-day opponents of birth control are using this historical connection to eugenics as a reason to limit birth control access today.
Oh, wow. So they just did a Uno reverse card on that one.
That's a perfect way to put it. I think it's hard to make sense of the story. I don't know if you're having that feeling.
Yeah, I that's exactly kind of how I'm feeling. It's just such a mixed bag of getting something we really needed in such an awful way.
Is there a, I don't know, a bright spot in this story for you?
I have to say it's those women in the courtroom that spoke up about what they needed. It sounds like to the judge and the legal system, they were kind of secondary. They weren't who they were fighting for. But it was an extremely brave thing to stand up in spite of that.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. I mean, you wanted a birth control ghost story.
Yeah, I got a lot more than I bargained for.
Any lingering questions?
I mean, where are the diaphragms?
But where are the diaphragms? There is a new one on the market, actually.
Is there?
It's purple.
Oh, I could get into that.
Hormone free. Best part? One size fits most.
Oh, good.
No diaphragm fitting parties required. If you have a burning question you can't find an answer to, give us a ring. 833-RING-ELT. 833-RING-ELT.
This episode was produced by Carla Javier, Hadley Robinson, Bethany Werner, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Littman, with help from Doug Barron. Our fact-checker is Nicole Pasulka. Our editors are Jorge Just and Caitlin Kinney. Music by Dara Hirsch, Catherine Anderson, Emma Munger, Sol Wiley. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. Every Little Thing is a Gimlet production and a Spotify original podcast. Goodbye.